I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. School uniforms, some see them as an aid to school spirit and a way to help avoid bullying and peer pressure. But are they an extra expense that parents shouldn't have to deal with? That's a question that Volusia County school officials are wrestling with right now. The school board discussed it this week. Board Chair Linda Costello says she's in favour.
I think it removes a lot of the competition over stuff and status, for one thing. Again, the security issue. Creating an environment that's focused on learning.
School districts across Central Florida have dress codes and some, but not all, schools have a mandatory uniform. Did a school uniform help you focus on your studies? Is it helping bring up morale at the school your kids go to? Or is it just one more thing to worry about for students and parents in the wind-up to the start of semester? Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. And joining me in the studio, Monivette Cordero, staff reporter with the Orlando Weekly. Hi, Monivette.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. And Matt Reed, columnist and host of the Matt Reed Show, all the way from Florida today. Thanks for coming in, Matt.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we're joined, as always, by Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Hey, Frank.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Well, let's talk about school uniforms. Do they help or hinder education? Plenty of schools say they're a good thing. Volusia County School Board Chair Linda Costello says they would improve security and level the playing field for students. We want to hear what you have to say. Let us know your thoughts about the school uniform. You can call us 1-866-338-5252 and join the conversation. There is some debate, though, over the merits of uniforms. Let's hear from Jade Rapoli. She's a Volusia County mother who supports them.
I believe that uniforms would create more sense of unity. It would eliminate the hassle of enforcing the dress code, which isn't currently enforced at all. Although I'm not quite sold that on the point that it would reduce bullying, it couldn't hurt.
And now let's hear from Lindsay Rodriguez. She's a mother who doesn't think uniforms are a good idea.
First of all, I don't think it would be cost effective because I'm going to be buying two wardrobes for my son. So at the end of the day, when he has to change out of his uniform from school and into his play clothes, I'm washing two sets of clothes. I'm a single mother. I do the best I can, and I can't afford a whole other wardrobe for my son, not to mention it's Florida, it's hot. The fact that they're not allowed to wear tank tops, you know, okay, I get that, but collared shirts in August in a school and you're out at PE, that's too much.
Well, what side are you on in this debate? Is the collared shirt a bridge too far for those muggy Florida August days? 1-866-338-5252. Please join the conversation. Monivette Cordero, before you worked for the Orlando Weekly, you worked for the Lakeland Ledger. Now, I know some Lake County elementary schools have a mandatory uniform policy. Has that been a controversial subject in Lake County?
In Lake County, I'm not sure. In Polk County, we have uniforms in the kids. You know, the first thing that they want to do when they get to high school is get out of the uniform. So I don't know, you know, how much they like that, how much it prevents bullying. They've never really said, but if it does, you know, who knows?
Mm-hmm. What about the idea of a dress code sort of helping with attitude and discipline? It seems like the jury's still out on that a little bit.
Yeah, the jury is definitely still out on that. You know, there are some schools, I think they, you know, go with the uniform, they go with the clear backpacks. But, you know, is it working or not? We can just look at the school and see that, you know, it's definitely not.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, school uniforms are one of the things candidates were asked for when Brevard County was picking a new superintendent a couple months back. Are there many uniform schools in the county and are they popular?
We have about a half dozen choice schools in Brevard County. They're magnet schools or they're specialty types of programs where the kids do wear uniforms. And I think our county tends to leave it to be a school-by-school choice issue. And some parents really like it. I can tell you, having had kids that went to Catholic school and then to public school, that the uniforms were cheaper. Mm-hmm. And the market for hand-me-downs was really pretty robust, so that helped a lot. In parts of Brevard County, the you know, you look at what the parents are wearing, you know, T-shirts and flip-flops. I mean, these kids would be going to school in wet bathing suits right from the beach if some of them. So there has to be some kind of a dress code. There's no flip-flops anymore, tank tops, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. But, you know, for the most part, the uniforms that we would see over there are those lightweight golf shirts and shorts. And,
right.
You know, it's not uncomfortable. And the schools where people do wear uniforms, the parents really seem to like it.
Mm-hmm. Going to go to the phones now. We have Jay Wheeler. Jay Wheeler, you're calling from Osceola County. What's on your mind?
Hi, my name is Jay Wheeler. I'm an Osceola County School Board member. Got elected in 2002, and we've had school uniforms since 2008. All of our kids, K through 12, 58,000 kids are going to show up August 24th, all wearing school uniforms. It's been the best thing that we've done. My biggest regret was we didn't do it sooner. High schools is where you really need it because you get girls showing up to school, you know, wearing high heels, belly shirts, with all the wrong things hanging out. It's a distraction. But on top of that, the main reason that we did it was because we had spikes in gang activity. We've had a documented decrease of gang activity in our schools of over 90%. Attendance has gone up. It's changed the culture of our schools. It's the best thing that we've done. And as far as affordability goes, you know, parents got to buy their kids clothes anyways. This is a good thing. Put your kids first. You know, anything, if you got to make a few sacrifices for your kid, if you got to make one more to get your kids golf shirts or, you know, khaki pants, et cetera, it's worth it. You know, and plus it's also increased the professional appearance of our instructional staff also.
Right.
You don't see teachers coming in wearing tank tops and flip-flops anymore. You know, they're dressed much more professionally. It's really been a great thing for Osceola County Schools. And if you want to impact positive change for your students and your schools, the least expensive, quickest way to do it is with school uniforms.
Jay Wheeler, interesting you say that. So you're saying the school uniforms has had a, like, can you draw a link between that and you're saying there's a reduced gang activity, did you say?
Correct. We did it specifically initially because our gang activity in Osceola County was spiking, was doubling every year. And, you know, in doing the research, you find out that clothing is integral to gang culture. Mm-hmm. Now, when I say gang activity, that doesn't mean fights or selling drugs, but you've got a large population of impressionable young people, and they want to belong to something, and they may, you know, come from a homeless background or a dysfunctional family, et cetera. And here are people who are embracing them. Well, we've eliminated that. You can't eliminate it 100%. No, you can't do anything, but you don't see kids with their pants down to their knees anymore, with the underwear hanging out. It's been a very, very positive thing for the school district. And to that end, just to illustrate it even further, we had a principal at Harmony High School that had a basketball tournament in 2007 when this was being debated. She confronted me and said she didn't want it. She was absolutely dead set against it. Well, fast forward, she became a deputy superintendent in her surrounding school district. She called me the first day of school saying, "Mr. Wheeler, I really wish we had school uniforms. I'm seeing these kids come without them. Mm-hmm. It makes a huge difference. I was dead wrong." We've had a lot of administrators who were dead set against it, and now they wouldn't do anything different. For example, we had a principal at Celebration High School who, in the first year we had school uniforms, she would allow the students to pay a dollar or two for a fundraiser to wear whatever they wanted. And she only let that happen a couple of times because it changed the culture at school. She doesn't do it again. She won't do it anymore.
Right.
School uniforms are as positive a thing as you can do. And those parents out there who are worrying, well, my son or daughter can't express their individuality, their creativity, have your son or daughter take a poetry class, a creative writing class, get into drama, take a music class. If they want to express themselves, there's plenty of opportunity.
Jay Wheeler, Osceola County School Board member, thank you so much for your call. Do appreciate it. Going to go to another call now. Chris, you're calling from Orlando. Chris, you're on the air. What's on your mind about uniforms?
Hey there. So I just wanted to say I went to Christian private school. I was in uniforms all of my young life. I have kids now who go to school in Seminole County, and I just think that uniforms is another way of sort of whitewashing a lot of differences in class and education quality. It doesn't change the quality of education to have a bunch of kids wear the same thing. I just don't understand really what the focus is on making kids look the same so that we don't have to, I don't know, understand them as different individuals.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's just a circuitous route to getting towards something like everyone having the same education or everyone being held to similar standards in school. To me, it really is just, it doesn't eliminate class discrimination in any way. Of course, you know, I had hand-me-downs when I went to a private school where plenty of people had the nicest khakis you could buy or the nicest shoes you could buy. And you could limit that by making them all purchase from the same provider. again, then you're just forcing parents sort of to buy and wear what we consider as the best. And I agree, too. The Florida weather here is crazy for long pants and collared shirts. So that's all I wanted to say. Thanks, guys, for having this conversation.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. Frank, as with everything, there's a political element to uniforms. I know this was something the Florida House was keen on. They were discussing the idea of an incentive, in fact, for uniforms. The Senate, not so much. A bill to offer elementary and schools money and middle schools, rather, money if they made uniforms mandatory didn't go anywhere in the Senate. What actually happened with that bill?
Well, you know, you said it right there. It really didn't go anywhere. And I think there's going to be some pushback involving these sort of elements because it's sort of the government sort of actually sort of removing some of the choices made by the parents and their mm-hmm. decisions to clothe their kids the way they choose to go to public school. So I think you'll see some pushback there. Of course, it'll be an issue along with testing and so many other education issues that'll be you'll see take towards the front of the education arena in the coming months. And parents will always have a say in these sort of matters, and they'll always be controversial, and there'll always be a lot of opinions involved as far as the education of children.
1-866-338-5252 if you want to join the conversation. We'd like to hear from you. What about this idea of uniforms? Has it made a difference in your school district? Maybe it's not such a good thing. Give us a call. 1-866-338-5252. Going to go to a call now from Gary. Gary, you're calling from Winter Park. Gary, you're on the air. What's on your mind about school uniforms? I think we seem to have lost Gary there. Let's go to Volusia County now, where they're discussing this debate. And we've got Jim calling from Volusia County. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you. I grew up here in New Smyrna Beach, in the Volusia County school system. When I grew up here and went to this school, you know, they're complaining about the weather here. When we went to school, there was no air conditioning in the high school whatsoever, and we survived. I think these kids today are controlling the parents and the school system by basically telling them what they'll do and what they won't do. Mm-hmm. And I think it carries on into the classroom. At our school, they have a dress code. I took my son to school one year, his first year there. They handed me a sheet of paper for a dress code. On that dress code, they said the kids couldn't wear bathing suits to school. They said they couldn't wear robes, bedroom robes to school. They said they couldn't wear bedroom slippers to school. I've been to the school due to my profession to do work at times. I've seen kids there, even with a dress code, wearing robes, wearing slippers, wearing flip-flops. And the issue of flip-flops alone is an issue. If kids are going up and down stairs, somebody could step in the back of it. You could have a traumatic fall. I've got a son who's got a traumatic brain injury. Mm. You could have a lawsuit in the school system.
So are you saying, Jim,
you also have to understand that these kids are going to school, and you're already in a society where sex is off the charts, and these young men have to go to school and learn. And they can't do it when they're distracted with these girls there.
Jim, you're making some interesting points. If I could just interrupt. So sounds like you're a supporter of this idea of rolling out a district-wide school uniform policy, or at least enforcing the dress code policy that they already have in Volusia County?
Absolutely. And I'm in business. Right. And I don't go to work in a tank top, flip-flops. There's very few professions where you're going to find that, and there's very few professions where you're ever going to have anybody hire you as an employee dressed like that.
Jim, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go to another call now, but I do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling in. Going to go now to Kevin. Kevin, you're calling from DeLand. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to bring up the importance of considering how a move like uniforms would be taken by the students. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard any compelling data yet about the benefits of going to uniforms, but I think it's kind of pandering or ignorant of a social reality for a high schooler to say that you can express yourself just by taking a drama class or a poetry class. What happens in the hallways is so hugely important for the life of these children, mm-hmm. and forcing them into uniforms, I think, would just kind of alienate them further from authority.
Kevin, calling from DeLand, thank you so much for your call. Do appreciate it. Monavet, we haven't heard too much about uniforms in Orange County. That's the biggest school district here in Central Florida. Do you think this is something that could be brought up with the Orange County School Board, for example?
I mean, yeah, definitely. If it's, you know, going around in the area. One comment that I found kind of interesting from the guy from Osceola was kind of this thing, you know, we don't want, you know, we want girls to be covered up. We don't want them mm-hmm. to their stuff to be falling out. And I think there's been a lot of pushback on social media from young people with, you know, when they're being sent home with a T-shirt, you know, on top because they were wearing a tank top or something. And they're saying, you know, we're just coming to school. We're not trying to be sexual beings. We're not trying to distract boys. We're just doing our schoolwork. So I feel like a lot of it at times can be, you know, body shaming for girls.
And that's tough. So you feel like maybe some of the students are getting the short end of the stick here in this whole uniform debate?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think definitely girls are, because, you know, the examples are always tank tops and, you know, who wears tank tops?
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about school uniforms, and we'll have some more to say about some other elements of the school year, things people are thinking about now as they start school. Testing, for example, what's happening with the Florida Standards Assessment? At least one county is considering a move to scrap that test altogether. Intersection will be back after a short break.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital. What is it that makes life so amazing? It's each member of the community doing our part to make life better. Because here in Central Florida, we're not just citizens, we're neighbors, we're friends, we're family. We're everything that makes life amazing.
Nice to have you along on your Friday morning. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News.
A tough job, but one person wants to do it. Be mayor of Ferguson, Missouri.
Government doesn't work fast. Change doesn't happen immediately. But I think most people recognize that progress is heading in the right direction.
Mayor James Knowles on lessons learned and healing wounds a year since the death of Michael Brown. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Tune in for The Takeaway today at noon on 90.7.
And you're back with Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for joining us. Here in the studio, we have Monivette Cordero, staff reporter with the Orlando Weekly, Matt Reed with the Matt Reed Show and Florida Today, and Frank Torres, editor of the Orlando Political Observer. We're talking about school uniforms. There's a big debate going on in Volusia County at the moment, and people calling in from around Central Florida. Osceola County just instituted a school uniform policy for all 50-some thousand students in their school district, and one board member thinks it's a great idea. It's really helped bring up the standard there in some other respects. What do you think about it? Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. We'd love to hear from you. Join the conversation. Going to go to Gretchen now. Gretchen, you're calling from Winter Springs. What's on your mind about school uniforms?
Well, actually, I think it's a wonderful idea, and I hope Volusia County can go through with it. I taught PE for 35 years in middle school, and the things that those kids were at school were just ridiculous, and it was very distracting, and we had a dress code, and we had several people that were in the administration that would really try to enforce that dress code, but you always have your gray areas unless mm-hmm. you have something, you know, definite. And with those uniforms, you get that. And one of the things you'll notice is the kids in private schools all wear uniforms. When our kids are expelled from school, they end up going to a special school, and they have to wear a uniform. Kids over in Europe, over in the Asian countries, they wear uniforms, and there's a reason for it. And I think we're just a little bit too easy with the kids. I think the uniforms make it easier for them to decide what to wear to school. I think it's a win-win situation all the way around.
Let me ask you one question, though, Gretchen. You said you taught PE, right?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh.
What about the idea of, you know, wearing a collared shirt, doing PE outside in the middle of a Florida summer? Is that, I mean, should there be some, you know, a bit of leeway for PE, or maybe something different they should wear on PE days?
On PE days, I think they should be wearing a cotton T-shirt and a pair of shorts that are loose, that are just easy to move around in, something that you can sweat in and take off and then change. A collared shirt, no. A dark shirt, no. Mm-hmm. It should be like a gray shirt. Gray shirts work the best because they don't show the dirt that much.
Right.
But a lot of the kids had the white shirts or yellow shirts or orange shirts in different schools, depending on their school colors. But we required them to wear it was like a heather-colored shirt and a red pair of shorts with the school colors, and it was kind of neat. But in PE, we wanted them to participate. So if they came in a change of clothes, we we had never had any like real strong funding or real strong backing against us or to support us to have uniforms.
Right.
So if the kids came in and they were wearing something they could participate in, they participated. But they, if they changed in my classes, they got extra credit. And because I didn't want them standing out just because they didn't wear their PE clothes and doing nothing and wasting all hour.
Got it. Gretchen,
so, you know,
thank you.
Different things there.
Thank you so much for your call. You're breaking up a little bit there, but I do appreciate you calling in and sharing your thoughts on the merits of the uniform. Let me ask you this, Matt Reed, as a parent, you mentioned that, you know, your kids going through school wearing uniforms. What about that idea of, you know, making it easier on parents to kind of, you know, not have to worry about what their kids are wearing to school?
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, your typical pair of shorts and a T-shirt today can cost you a nice, you know, especially if it's one of those nice brands or it's got some kind of logo that the kids like. My kids went to Catholic school and then they switched over to public school, and our budget went up for clothes when they came out of Catholic school. There was always parents, you know, the kids grow, that would hand down uniforms. They were cheap. They weren't very expensive to buy. They it wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. You know, it really I didn't see it make a tremendous difference in the behavior of the students, because the students that were at that school to begin with were kind of selected because their parents wanted them to be in a
right.
Catholic environment. And like I said, in Brevard County, we have a number of choice schools, mm-hmm. magnet programs, a science school, that kind of thing, where the kids wear uniforms. That's part of the experience. And the parents that go and the students that go to those schools, they all seem pretty content with the uniform approach. But elsewhere, dress codes are important, because kids will really dress down in this heat. And I think dress code has actually become a verb in that I heard my kids would say, I got dress coded today because I outgrew my shorts a little bit. And, you know, it's time to go to the store and get some slightly longer, you know, mm-hmm. shorts. But mm-hmm.
And that's something you were talking about, Monavit, the idea of getting dress code and kids being sent home for mm-hmm. what sometimes sounds like sort of pretty minor infractions there.
Right. And, you know, they get sent to the office. They have to put this long T-shirt. It's shaming for a lot of them. You know, a teacher, you know, calling you out, you know, hey, that skirt is way too short. You know, it kind of leads to mixed feelings, I think, among students.
Mm-hmm. We're going to move on. We're still talking about education, though. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of the testing, though. Now, 2 weeks ago, Eric Garvey, the executive director of Space Coast Office of Tourism, was quoted in a Central Florida News 13 reporter saying the early starts cut into the all-important summer tourism season. So Brevard County schools have gone back to school already. On the flip side of that, though, some educators say it's a good idea so students can get exams out of the way before the Christmas break. Now, what do you think about the early start? Is it killing your summer? What about the impact on tourism for those beach economies? 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Or maybe you're happy to be looking at a school term that doesn't include exams after Christmas. Parents, educators, students, join the conversation. 1-866-338-5252. Matt Reed, let me ask you this. Just how much argument is there over the new school calendar and the earlier start in Brevard County?
Not much among the parents and students. Every year there's a little bit of this angst that, you know, we're starting school before the big holiday weekend like a lot of other counties do. Again, the tourism industry wants to hang on to that cheap high school labor another week to get a little bit more out of it, and they're sad to see those students go. But it does make a big difference to families to be able to get those final exams and the other testing kinds of things done before the big holiday break.
Mm-hmm.
Kids will take off, you know, for 2-3 weeks over the holidays, then come back and they haven't retained things and they've got to finish up a semester. That's weird, and it's tougher on the parents and the teachers and the students.
Mm-hmm.
So academically, it's worked out better, and it's an option, I should point out, that Brevard County and some other school districts have because they're high performing districts. If you are a high performing district according to the state standards, you have that option of setting, you know, playing with your start times. If you're not, then you don't get that choice.
Monavit Cordero, there's not a lot of consistency, though, if you look across the entire state and in Central Florida. Do you think there needs to be some more consistency in terms of, you know, when kids are going back to school, whether in Brevard, Volusia, Polk, or maybe Orange County?
I think so. I think, like you were saying, you know, academically they get their tests in. It's better for overall. As a student, I would be upset because my summer was cut. You know, I think, yeah, definitely that there should be uniform across all that way. You know, all students don't feel left out or,
Frank Torres, could we see some more legislative tinkering, do you think, with the school calendar?
You know, as far as the school calendar goes, I think that battle's pretty much settled for now. There was some pushback during the legislative session from the theme parks. They're cutting into the bottom line. You know, they're asking legislators, hey, that's one more week, that's two more weeks where Florida families, are, you know, our base audience, could be in our parks, you know, spending money and increasing an already, you know, fledging, you know, tourism industry to really, you know, move the dollars along. So I think as far as scheduling goes, that's pretty much about it for now. There could be a murmur or two in the next legislative session. But I think really the direction everybody is going as far as education goes is testing.
And let me ask about tourism. You mentioned that, Frank Torres. It's important in Orlando just as much out in Brevard County. Is there some pushback from the theme park operators on that early start?
Yeah, they didn't. They frankly, weren't very fond of it, and they there were some phone calls made, and the lobbyists up there in Tallahassee took a position trying to remove that component from the education agenda over the last previous legislative session. But it was with so much going on in education, with school uniforms, with student testing, and budget concerns. You'll recall there was a budget fight to try to, you know, raise funding per pupil.
Sure.
There was just so much going on, and the schedule. The scheduling aspect or the early aspect sort of got lost in the shuffle. So obviously the theme parks will continue to try to do what they can to make sure that their sides are covered. And it'll just be another aspect of that wide education discussion that you'll see stretching into the coming months.
Mm-hmm. As you say, there's quite a lot going on in terms of what's happening in education. Just going back to school uniforms, people really want to talk about it. We're going to Natalie. Natalie, you're on the air from DeBarry.
My name is Natalie, like you said, and I come from Haiti. I was raised there, and for most of my life, I wore a uniform, and it was most comfortable. Of course, when you're talking about change, there's always some resistance, and it's not understood until it's implemented and you actually see the change. There is a change in attitude. There is a change in self-respect. I have my siblings. They are moving from Palm Beach County, and their school implemented uniform, and they are now coming to Volusia County. And they are so used to it. Like, even when they went to the store and they had the choice of picking some things that were not allowed in Palm Beach County, they actually were not comfortable with that. You know, they are...
So Natalie, you're saying that the kids that you've talked to about it, they think the uniforms are good? It sort of simplifies things for them?
Yes, they totally... agree with it. They wear it. They felt comfortable in it. And there's also that, you know, when you are in a room with a professor, and there's this really, you should cover yourself up. You're kind of like, I work in a construction business. I don't want to go to work with a bunch of guys and I'm showing myself up.
Right.
There are other places where you can do that. You're only in school for what? 6 hours or something like that out of the day.
Natalie, thanks for your call. And just on the idea of only being in school for 6 hours or so, I'm sure some students would say, well, it's too long. Those school days can seem pretty long. But Natalie, I do appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts. I'm going to take one more call on school uniforms. Here's an idea from Teresa. Teresa, you're calling from Orlando. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. First of all, dress codes cannot keep up with the style. And I have often thought that in the high school that there could be a contest, perhaps, with whatever they call home economics today, to design clothing that the students might wear. Of course, it would have to be approved. But in the meantime, things like collarless shirts versus collar shirts, why not have choice? And shorts in Florida would be fine. Shorts, skorts, whatever. There could still be some choice within uniform.
Teresa, thank you so much for your call. And that's an interesting idea about having a design competition. I'm sure there could perhaps be some input from students, even if they're not designing the uniforms themselves, maybe some input into choosing what the uniform actually is. Let's move on, though, and talk about testing. That's another issue of hot debate in the realm of education. In Seminole County, Superintendent Walt Griffin, the superintendent of the school district up in Seminole County, says testing takes up too much classroom time. Add to that computer malfunctions. He says it makes it more sense to go to a paper and pencil test like the Iowa test or the SAT. Well, parents, is Seminole County onto something here? Does the Florida Standards Assessment need another look, or maybe a replacement test altogether? You can join the conversation, 1-866-338-5252. Frank Torres, some other counties have also expressed, obviously, a bit of frustration with the FSA test. Is the legislature going to have to take another look at this assessment?
You know, I'm glad you brought this subject up, especially Seminole County and Walt Griffin's push to really sort of change up the testing standards there. I had an interview with two of the school board members from Seminole County, Amy Lockhart and Tina Calderon, and some of the dollars being spent and the approval rate of this current testing system really is down in the dumps. There's complaints about a lack of transparency involved with the tests, the computer system resulting in lost days of testing. And normally in this partisan world of politics where it's always R's versus D's, red versus blues, there seems to be a universal disapproval of the current testing systems. And an independent study is due to come back on the evaluation of the study is due to come back on September 3rd. There'll be a lot of opinions on those findings, and this is just the beginning of what is a very emotional process to really try to evolve this this embattled testing system.
Mm-hmm. Bonavette, I wonder what your thoughts are on testing. You know, going through school, did you kind of get the sense that there was a lot of testing, maybe too much testing?
Definitely. I didn't graduate from high school too long ago, so I definitely have been through that testing with the, you know, they used to be FCAT. And I think they mentioned in some stories that the Seminoles are kind of wanting to go with a PSAT, mm-hmm. which, you know, high schoolers already take. It'd be interesting to see if they would also provide the SAT, you know, to older students, and that way, you know, also they can use that for their college scores.
Matt Reed, what are your thoughts on testing? You know, somebody who's taken a look at this idea for some time. I know that, you know, a lot of things in education, they get sort of hashed over and hashed over, but the idea of testing has never been an easy one to solve. Where do you see this going?
Well, first of all, I think that testing and accountability made a tremendous difference and a tremendous impact on Florida and led to incredible improvement in our education and its reputation over the past decade because educators had assessment and tools and information to work with, and they took that job seriously. And I think most educators really do want to improve and do best by their kids. Mm-hmm. Where we've arrived today is a thatch of testing that just keeps building up and building up. And we just recently had a conversation with Desmond Blackburn, our new superintendent in Brevard County, and he had an interesting take on this. We asked him, how do you cut back on this testing? How do you get control of it? And he said, well, before we start launching some kind of political protest against Tallahassee and getting rid of the one major test that is aligned with the standards that we have to achieve, why don't we look inward? And what he said was, what you have is a state test, and then districts to prepare and assess for that state test impose their whole testing regime. Then you have principals who want to make sure that their teachers and students are ready for that district test, so they lay down another set mm-hmm. of assessments and practice. And then teachers who want to do well on it start requiring their students to assess and test. So from the district and school level, they are imposing a whole new battery of tests that add up and compound with this state test that probably isn't all that bad. The computer issue is another circumstance. It is very expensive and it's been problematic, but in terms of assessment, it may not be all that bad to have that one state test and then maybe honor that law that was passed back about 7 or 8 years ago that said you don't do a lot of extra special stuff to prepare for the FCAT. You don't mm-hmm. you don't dedicate class time or school time, or you don't have rallies when you should be in the classroom just learning to get ready for more tests.
Mm-hmm. Well, testing, obviously, it's something that's generating a lot of conversation and people can be sort of worked up about it on both sides of the issue. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, we'll talk about the week in Tallahassee, where lawmakers are trying to draw new congressional maps after the Florida Supreme Court ruled the old maps unconstitutional, and we'll talk about the Apopka City Council's move to crack down on panhandling. Taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns in a moment.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Mayo Clinic, where cancer specialists turn research and innovation into individualized patient care so each patient receives effective treatment tailored to their exact needs, right here in Florida. More at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
Good morning. We made it to Friday. You're listening to Intersection, where you can call in and join the conversation. This is 90.7 News.
Low oil prices are hurting places like Alice, Texas, where the oil industry is the economy.
I can hear the cry all over town now. Everybody's suffering. And like I've always said, we chose the industry. It didn't choose us. And we're just paying for it now.
From oil boom to bust in one Texas city, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen in for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Monivette Cordero from the Orlando Weekly, Matt Reed, Florida Today, and Frank Torres, Orlando Political Observer. Well, it's another week, another special session. This is the third time, lawmakers have schlepped back to Tallahassee, this time to try again with new congressional boundaries. The Florida Supreme Court ruled 8 of the districts unconstitutional, and there's some bipartisan criticism of the proposed new maps. Let's hear from Daniel Webster, a Republican from Central Florida.
The new configuration for District 10 makes the seat uncompetitive for anyone in my party, including me. Therefore, given the facts I've just provided, I believe an affirmative vote for this plan that's before you, whether it's a suggested plan or whatever, this plan is a specific intent to disfavor me as an incumbent.
On the other side of the aisle, Corrine Brown, a Democrat, tried to join a lawsuit protesting the redistricting. That lawsuit was withdrawn, so then she said she'll file her own lawsuit. Frank Torres, why is Central Florida ground zero for redistricting?
I think because we have two of the districts in question right here in the heart of the area. You've got Daniel Webster's Orlando district, the 10th district here, and you've got Corrine Brown's district, which is the center of all the controversy, which stretches from Eatonville and some of the other areas here in the community through Sanford all the way up to Jacksonville, a peninsula within a peninsula, if you will. And you've got two of these areas which are at the center of the argument, which is why Central Florida is getting so much attention and which why it could have so much effect of the election results coming in the next year.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense from what you've seen lawmakers get up to in Tallahassee this week that they'll be able to get that map drawn up with no hiccups?
I believe that the proposed maps right there, they're going to go with those moving into next week for the to begin the approval phase, and then they'll resubmit those. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of wrangling going on behind the scenes, and there's redistricting. The way these lines are drawn are always going to bring up debate and discussion, but the process is going to move along. And keep in mind, this is just the congressional maps. They've got to go back and draw the state Senate maps next month as well.
Mm-hmm. It seems, too, moving on to something a little aside from redistricting, that some lawmakers need some extra work in Tallahassee. We had Rich Workman. He's a lawmaker from the Brevard County area. It turns out he's working as an Uber driver on the side. Matt Reed, was that a surprise to you?
Actually not when it comes to Rich Workman. He is such an extrovert who just loves to talk and engage people. You know, here's a guy who, I mean, I just can't believe it. I mean, what do you do after a day of back slapping and arm twisting and talking and debating and all that kind of stuff? Why you take a job where you get to talk to more people, mm-hmm. which is half his motivation, of course. You know, I mean, most lawmakers that take that job aren't able to work a full-time job on a steady basis, so they might need a little extra money. I think it's interesting to see that in his own district in Brevard County, you now have cities like Melbourne that are looking at at first they were going to deregulate a little bit of their taxi rules to let Uber in. Now they're flipping back that other direction where they might use the taxi laws to squeeze Uber out. So would Rich Workman be unable to practice his night job in his own district because of some of the regulations? I think that'll be something that I want to talk to him about.
Mm-hmm. Interesting conversation there. Well, let's move on from redistricting and talk about panhandling. Now, Apopka is targeting panhandlers. The Orlando Sentinel reports bicycle patrols are cracking down, handing out trespass warnings in downtown Apopka. They're also handing out information on services available to the homeless. Counties across Central Florida have anti-panhandling ordinances. Is this the right approach? Do you get approached by panhandlers on your commute? And what's your response when you do? Call us 1-866-338-5252. What is the right approach to panhandling? 1-866-338-5252. Frank Torres, how does this anti-panhandling tactic fit into Apopka Mayor Joe Kilsheimer's new approach to governing the city?
You know, Joe Kilsheimer's had so many issues involved during his first first year in office, both some well-received and some not well-received. You'll recall there was the situation with the VFW, renting those facilities, the moratorium, attempted moratorium on fast food restaurants, and now this panhandling ordinance. It really is about his overall push to try to change that culture and really try to move the city of Apopka, the second largest city in Orange County, into a new direction. And this isn't just an Apopka problem. There's a homelessness problem in Central Florida, and you're seeing a lot of Central Florida lawmakers really try to get in front of this and try to make some reforms.
1-866-338-5252 is the number to call. We're talking about panhandling, homelessness, and how different counties and cities approach the issue differently. Monavet Cordero, let's talk about the homelessness issue. Now, panhandling laws, as you know, have their critics. Orange County Public Defender Bob Wesley talked about this week about how people arrested for panhandling often have mental health issues. And Wesley said there's a cycle of arrests and fines that builds up. Let's just hear a little bit from Bob Wesley talking at a press conference on Tuesday.
One fellow we know because we talked to him in the state hospital just 2 weeks ago. His offense was panhandling. He got court calls for panhandling. Now he's back in jail for not paying the cost, and we know him to be a person that eats from garbage cans and who begs for money on the street. This is not a guy that's going to be able to pay the cost.
Well, Monavet Cordero, Central Florida leaders, as you know, are making a big push to try and reduce homelessness. How do these panhandling laws, or maybe a patchwork of how they're enforced, how does that all fit into this new approach?
Right. And as Mr. Wesley mentioned in that same news conference, he said, you know, homelessness, being homeless is criminalized. You know, when you want to have a beer at home, you go and you sit on your couch and you have a beer. When you want to have a beer and you're homeless, you know, you have to find a bench and you may be moved off that bench or you may be moved out of that park. So I think as a whole, you know, these laws sometimes, you know, criminalize things that you wouldn't be able to do, you know. You can't live outside kind of and be homeless. So it's an interesting topic, and especially, you know, coming with that it did this news conference kind of surface from that hospice patient that was arrested.
Right.
You know, for not paying. And, you know, he's about to die. So.
Right. Well, cities like Orlando and Apopka, can they find a balance, Monavet, between law enforcement and maybe giving out social welfare? It sounds like Apopka's trying to do a little bit of that. The bicycle patrol officers, they're handing out some information. They're handing out warnings for panhandling rather than just outright arresting people on the first go-round. But how do cities find this balance between, you know, enforcing the laws and trying to help folks who are obviously down on their luck?
Yeah, I think, I mean, kind of arresting them also just puts them back into the system. It's a vicious cycle, and it goes from, you know, jail to shelter back to jail. So, you know, cities are really going to have to address, you know, exactly what they want to do with the homeless problem. And as I was talking with Mr. Donald White from the Homeless Coalition yesterday, and he said, you know, the approach that's been pushed down from HUD is housing first.
Right.
Mm-hmm. At the city of Melbourne just passed a law
with
this whole process.
That was last year, right?
Yeah, just in the past year. And in fact, had its first arrest, I think, maybe 6 months ago on this issue. But the way that they had to find a balance was they created a zone in the downtown area that was a solicitation-free area. The key here is that the law has to be content neutral, right? So not only you can't have panhandling there, right? Because that's a form of free speech. But then, right, if you're not going to have that, you also can't have Boy Scouts down there, you know, having a boot drop for change. You can't have political parties down there asking for donations or any of that kind of stuff. So none of that can happen. And it's really the aggression. They call it aggressive panhandling.
Right.
It relies on people calling and reporting somebody in. Mm-hmm. And if somebody's just saying, "Hey, brother, you got a dime?" Nobody's calling about that. It's when you've got somebody who's whacked out of their mind on drugs or alcohol and they're wandering through, weaving through traffic, trying to, you know, go up to car windows and get money, or they're cussing at somebody after they refuse to give them money, chasing them down the street and they feel intimidated. That's really the dividing line that I think they found in the city.
We're talking about panhandling and the sort of patchwork approach from cities and counties in terms of how they tackle panhandling, how they deal with other issues regarding the homeless. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. We'd like to hear from you. Matt Reed from Florida Today, how is the law being responded to by the folks out in Melbourne? Is it a popular law, that anti-panhandling law?
Well, I think it is. I mean, there were workshops on this, and the downtown merchants and some of their customers felt intimidated by some of the panhandling. They obviously just don't like the looks of it. Some of it is almost like a sign that your downtown has arrived, right? You know, when you have enough people down there shopping and dining and doing that kind of thing, that the panhandlers feel like there's, you know, a source of money for them. That's part of growing up as a nice downtown. So they had that in Melbourne. But, you know, I think one of the other things that they really had to do was strike that balance between, you know, passing an ordinance that wasn't going to violate First Amendment considerations, mm-hmm. if somebody sued, and somebody might do that. And they had – I may botch this, but within the law, within the precedent, things like sidewalks and streets and access and free flow of economic activity is considered a public good.
Right.
And if the panhandling or so-called speech is interfering with that public good, that's where the city can find the grounds in which to enact an ordinance like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on from panhandling and talk about soccer. The Orlando City Soccer Club announced this week the women's national soccer team is coming to the Citrus Bowl later in the year. The match is part of the World Cup Winners' Victory Tour. They'll play the Brazilian national team in a friendly contest October 25th. Orlando City President Phil Rawlins says the game is expected to draw some 40,000 fans. Are you one of those fans? Will you be heading to the Citrus Bowl? And has having a home team here in Orlando in the Major League turned you into a soccer nut? We want to hear what you have to say. 1-866-338-5252. Earlier this week, soccer blogger Andrew Marcinko spoke to 90.7's Brendan Byrne about the move to make Orlando a soccer city.
The long-stated goal has been for Orlando to be the soccer capital of the South. You'll hear the team president and owner saying that over and over again, and this is just another step in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, Monavet, what do you think? Is Orlando becoming the soccer capital of the South? What are you seeing in the City Beautiful?
I hope so, especially with, you know, the rise with people who are Brazilian origin coming here and living here, especially we have Kaká on the team. Mm-hmm. So I definitely hope so because I would enjoy it. I'm tired of baseball.
Right. The support of the Orlando City Lions, the city's Major League Soccer team, is kind of overwhelming. I mean, they get big crowds every single home game, it seems. Did you expect this?
Definitely. I think especially with you know, the match between Japan and the USA and the FIFA Women's World Cup being, you know, one of the most watched. It's definitely going to be interesting to see how Americans, you know, learn to love soccer.
Mm-hmm. Can they sustain this wave of support for soccer, do you think? Or does the city need to do other things to really make sure that this gets established as a soccer capital?
Well, I definitely think, you know, we need to... since we do have such popular support for the women's national team, we definitely need to have a little bit more focus on that.
Mm-hmm. Matt Reed, what about out in Brevard County? Is soccer a popular thing out there? I know you've got some baseball going on, that sort of thing, but what about soccer?
Oh, listen, with all due respect to the Orlando Magic and the Predators, which, you know, put on their own types of great shows, the Orlando City Lions is the best professional sports activity I've attended here in Orlando, and there's a great growing fan base over in Brevard County, which is a soccer crazy place. Mm-hmm. At the youth and high school level, you see those little purple car magnets everywhere over there, and it's not a surprise to me to hear that with the Orlando Lions launching a developmental team, that they're actually talking to Eastern Florida State over in Melbourne as being the potential location for that. I think it's a great fit for Central Florida, and I think it's a blast. I think the one thing to keep in mind is that I'm pushing 50, and I grew up playing soccer mm-hmm. in a competitive way, and to take my family and to go and watch it really brings back great memories, and it's not a weird alien sport at all anymore to your typical, you know, mom and dad and their kids, and I think that's a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. Also, just the festival atmosphere downtown Melbourne and all along Church Street, and that is, I think it makes it part of the experience, and it's what we look forward to coming over for.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, do you see the soccer wave sustaining in Central Florida and Orlando?
I do, and I still think that the grandest gesture of it all was the Orlando City Soccer stepping up and self-financing that stadium. I think after they did that, they really removed all objections over why the community should not support that team. And they do have a great product. When you go out there, everybody's having a great time. It's a lot of fun, and I do believe this will be the soccer capital of the South, if it's not already.
Real quickly, in the last 30 seconds here, Frank, do you see the city trying to get some more state funding next year?
You know, the charge for funding will never stop, but certainly self-financing that stadium was a step in the right direction. And with this whole community behind them, it just might help them do that.
Well, thanks for joining us for Intersection. Frank Torres is the editor of the Orlando Political Observer. Thanks, as always, Frank.
Yes, sir.
And Matt Reed, we are joined from Florida today, and he's also the host of the Matt Reed Show. Matt, thanks for coming in.
So great to be here.
And Monavet Cordero, a staff writer at the Orlando Weekly. Thank you so much, Monavet.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Production assistance from this week's show from Amy Green and Nicole Kristen. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, executive producer Catherine Welch. Join us next Tuesday morning at 9. We'll be talking about the Orlando neighborhood of Paramore, the soccer stadium, and other big changes ahead. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.